Listen local.
Live from WJFF Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo, in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, the regional food bank's big move. They're opening a new distribution center that's twice the size of their current warehouse, increasing the capacity of food distribution to over 400 food pantries and soup kitchens for those in need. We'll learn more about how this new facility will help fight food insecurity. Medical experts warn of a new COVID-19 variant as infection rates grow in the New York's this summer. We speak to medical director of Ellenville Regional Hospital for the latest. The In the Works, In the Woods Festival at Forsberg Playhouse, Franklin Trapp and Matt Lenz, who are here to talk about the annual theater festival celebrating emerging artists and new works. Plus, local economic perspective from very own James B. Huntington. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened sharply lower this morning as worries about the U.S. economy sparked a worldwide sell-off. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 800 points in early trading.
Market jitters that began with last week's jobs report are now sending shockwaves around the world as investors worry the U.S. economy, long a pillar of global growth, is starting to show some cracks. Stocks fell sharply in Europe and Asia, with Japan's Nikkei average tumbling more than 12%, its worst day in nearly four decades. A measure of market fear more than doubled after a rise in the U.S. unemployment rate triggered worries that the world's largest economy could be headed for recession. Tech stocks, which had been at the forefront of the market's boom, are being pummeled. Long-term investor Warren Buffett revealed that Berkshire Hathaway had cut its stake in Apple by nearly half. Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Hurricane Debby has made landfall in Florida's Big Bend region on the Gulf Coast. Top sustained winds are at 75 miles per hour. Forecasters are warning of several feet of storm surge on the coast and torrential rain. Crews in Northern California are slowly making progress to contain the largest active wildfire in the U.S. Containment of the Park Fire north of Sacramento is by one-third. The National Interagency Fire Center says much of the West has large wildfires. From member station KUNC, Ray Solomon reports on blazes in Colorado.
A fire that burned more than 1,500 acres in Boulder County is now completely contained. At a second fire in Larimer County, hundreds of firefighters have been working around the clock. Fire spokesman Andy Lyon says that fire is now more than halfway contained.
That's due to a lot of hard work from firefighters on the ground and the pilots who've been dropping water and retardant over the last week.
Evacuated residents are starting to head home to assess the damage. Meanwhile, two other wildfires in Jefferson and Montrose counties are still burning. For NPR News, I'm Ray Solomon.
Bangladesh's prime minister has resigned following weeks of deadly protests. NPR's Dia Hadid reports Bangladesh's army chief has announced the formation of an interim government.
Opposition leaders shared images purporting to show the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina near a helicopter and footage of a helicopter leaving the capital, even as local media filmed tens of thousands of protesters marching onto the capital, Dhaka. Some appeared to storm the residence of the Prime Minister, with local media capturing men sitting on the roof of one building waving flags. The protests began in early July over student demands to reduce government job quotas for veterans of Bangladesh's War of Independence. But days after protests began, loyalists of Sheikh Hasina's party violently attacked demonstrators. Media outlets estimate more than 300 people have been killed so far. Dia Hadid, NPR News, New Delhi.
You're listening to NPR News. Vice President Harris is expected to announce her running mate by tomorrow at the latest. The three potential candidates who've gotten the most attention are Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. Harris secured enough votes last week from Democratic Convention delegates to earn the party's presidential nomination. The delegate voting will be concluded tonight. Marvel's Deadpool and Wolverine has set a record at the box office for R-rated films. As NPR's Bob Mondello reports, that record comes with an asterisk.
Marvel's buddy superheroes have reached a new milestone.
Let's give the people what they came for!
With $395 million in the till in North America, they've comfortably passed the $370 million earned by the previous R-rated record holder, Mel Gibson's 2004 religious epic, The Passion of the Christ.
I'm the Messiah.
Not just yet. No shade on Deadpool, but his totals look less impressive, adjusted for inflation. The average ticket price in 2004 was about $6. Today, it's almost $11. So while Marvel's Super Buddies have been seen by a respectable 36 million fans in U.S. cinemas, Passion of the Christ played 20 years ago to almost 60 million moviegoers. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
The U.S. has won the silver medal in the Olympics mixed triathlon event today. Initially, the U.S. was awarded bronze, but the Americans challenged that call. The judges reviewed the results and awarded the U.S. the silver, moving Britain to the bronze medal. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Urbayo, in for Tian Bruno. The Regional Food Bank provides 50 million pounds of food each year to 1,000 agencies in 23 counties of the northeastern New York. To meet the growing demand, they are moving to a new 40,000 square foot distribution center that will be twice the size of the food bank's current warehouse in Cornwall on Hudson and enable it to increase the capacity of food it distributes to 400 food pantries and soup kitchens in Orange, Sullivan, Ulster, Dutchess, Rockland, and Putnam counties. And joining us live in studio is Felicia Callan, and Executive VP of the Regional Food Bank, and Senior Public Affairs Officer Barry Lewis, with more on this big move. Welcome both of you to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, so Felicia, let's start with you. Let's remind folks of the mission of the Regional Food Bank of Hudson Valley.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for having us. And the Regional Food Bank is really one food bank in two locations. Our mission is to lead a network of partners to alleviate hunger, to prevent food waste, and to nourish the communities that we serve. So our vision is really that all people would have access to nutritious food that they really need to thrive. And we distribute over 48 million pounds of healthy food in the 23 counties. Our CEO is Tom Nadachi, who really leads us from Latham. And we're excited to continue to meet this growing need to meet people where they are. And we're excited to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So Barry, if you want to sort of give us a snapshot of food insecurity rates in the region currently.
Yeah, I think, people have this idea that, post COVID things are better and everything, everything's back to normal. The sad reality is that post COVID things have gotten worse. Food prices have increased by 12%. I think most of our listeners would agree that their salaries have not increased by 12%, certainly in just the last 2 years. The post-pandemic or the pandemic programs that aided folks financially have ended. And so people are being hit with a greater increase in how much food costs. So there's been a rise in food insecurity. In Sullivan County, the food insecurity rate is 13.1%. Mm. Unfortunately, and not surprisingly, it is the highest of those six counties that you talked about. Ulster County is about 12.8%. So those two counties have the highest increase of the six counties. And when we say food insecurity, we're talking about 1 in 9 adults or 1 in 7 children may not know where the next meal is coming from.
Wow. So did the increase of the need for food insecurity from the community sort of spur on this new facility, or has this been sort of in the works for a while?
There's been in the works for a while, but certainly the need for it to grow and develop and what it could bring for the Hudson Valley in particular is going to make a generational difference. And you had said 40,000 square feet, and those were, I think, the numbers I probably gave you, but it's increased. It's almost now 50.
Wow.
It's going to more than double the size of our current facility in Cornwall and Hudson, which if some of you listeners may know, that's on the very eastern portion of Orange County. It's a very beautiful area, but it's very hard and difficult for those large tractor trailers that people are used to seeing bringing in food. The USDA brings in 20 million pounds of food every year to the Hudson Valley. But unfortunately, those trucks were not able to get to Cornwall. So those trucks had to go back up to Latham and then from Latham, we had to bring, we being the food bank, had to bring trucks down, about 12 million of it, which came down to the Hudson Valley. So drivers, time frame, food was, you know, you're keeping food on trucks longer, and all that will change with a 50,000 square foot facility in the village of Montgomery, right by Orange County Airport, not Stewart Airport, Orange County Airport. And the distance from where 87 is, 8417, is about 10, 15 minutes on all those directions. So it's going to have a major impact on how we're going to be able to provide food. And, you know, even Felicia would tell you, just the what's going to be available in that site is really transformative as well.
It's going to be a state-of-the-art facility, and we're able to increase our capacity and really feed people and work with our agency partners in a way that we've never done before. And we know that this has to happen. We know that we have to continue to build these partnerships and work together. And there are already a lot of agencies on the ground that see the need. And so they're excited to see this new transformation of our space that will increase our capacity. So we get our food from, you know, farmers. We're bringing in, we're really a distribution center. So in order to, you know, intake more, we need a larger facility, and this will allow us to more than double our capacity and continue to meet the growing need.
Wow, that's really good. So really, you're sort of like the center of everything now.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. And again, there's amazing partners on the ground, and we're really just helping them get what they need to meet the needs of the community.
So when is the grand opening, and can folks get a tour of it once is it opened?
So obviously we're under construction, and there is a timeline. Right now, our main initiative are hard hat tours. So if you're interested in touring the facility, although it's still under construction, you can reach out to us, and we're happy to do that. We're going to be doing those tours on Wednesdays. There's so many ways that you can get involved. You can still volunteer at our Cornwall location, or if you want to volunteer in Latham. And obviously when the Montgomery site is up and running, there's a million ways that you can get involved and reach out to us and be a part of this process. We also have a gala coming up on November 7th. So another great way to, you know, introduce yourself to us, get involved, and Barry can probably fill you in on more in terms of the grand opening.
Sure.
Yeah, so obviously we bring in, we will need about 10,000 volunteers in the new facility. And we're reaching out to civic organizations. We've already spoken to the Rotary and Kiwanis and Monticello and Liberty, and they're very excited. School groups. We partner with Aldi's and Breeze Egg Farm. We get food from Stop and Shop and Hannaford's and ShopRite. And so all these folks and a lot of the business community wants their employees to take part. They encourage employees. So if they simply go to regionalfoodbank.net, they can find out how to volunteer, and they'll also be able to find out about the hard hat tours. As Felicia said, we're looking somewhere near around the end of fall to open up the facility, and I think people will be blown away what they'll see. You know, the thought that it's simply just a warehouse is I think maybe the mindset, or a distribution center. And it really is going to be, it's that and also an education, a creative process. We're looking to be the central point where people will be able to understand about food insecurity, and nourishment of food. We just don't, I think people have that old mindset of, we're going to donate canned food, and, you know, they'll donate a dented can and they'll give. And that is not what the food bank does these days, for sure. You know, it's nearly 70% is fruits and vegetables and greens and healthy food. And so that is the mindset. That's what we're trying to get across. Now, you know, if kids want a good Oreo, we're happy to do that. We understand people want to enjoy food, but we really want to educate people and have them understand that healthy food doesn't have to be expensive, and it can be quick and easy. And I think just people have a different mindset. So not only are we providing food, but we're also going to look to increase the education of food.
Right. I mean, I've been to one food bank in the Bronx when I used to live there, working as a journalist. I went to the food bank in Hunts Point, I think, with the area. I was blown away by just the operation, because that's exactly what I thought. I thought it was just a warehouse store of food. But just imagine just seeing all the operation that goes on, all the volunteers working together to get the food distributed. So what's going to happen to the old location in Cornwall and the Hudson?
Right. So we will operate from both locations and then phase out. So we'll no longer be there will be a point of time where we'll no longer be at the Cornwall location, but we're going to need some time to get there. Right. So we will be fully operational in Latham and Montgomery as the distribution centers. I also want to highlight, not only are we a distribution center, but we have a lot of programs, particularly here in Sullivan County for children. We have the backpack program where we have partnered with the school district to distribute healthy food. So we know that kids are going home on the weekends and they're going to get meals, good nutritious meals. We have a school pantry. We have farm stand sites. There's so many programs that we have, and we want to increase those programs so that we can meet the need really from all facets.
Right. And folks who are interested in, you know, who might need help or know somebody who does need help, where can they sort of find food pantries or food agency to get that help?
Once again, they can go to the website, regionalfoodbank.net. They can call, and I'm sure, you know, people can give you the number. It's 518-786-3691. That is in Latham, 518-786-3691. Or just type in regionalfoodbank.net, and you're going to get a lot of information. You know, there are, as we said, there's two locations, but we are one group. And we're working with a lot of partners, and we work with a single bite in Sullivan County. We know we can't be everywhere, and we know we have partners that are already are established and boots on the ground. The Food Bank in the Hudson Valley has been around for over 25, 30 years. But, you know, it was one of these things that we brought food, we brought boxes in, we brought boxes out. And what we're trying to do is bring a greater awareness of food insecurity and what the food bank does. People may be surprised to find out just how many pantries that we provide food to. And I understand people go to a pantry, they go to the church, they're part of the backpack program, and they get their food, and, you know, they think that that's where the food came from. But the reality is the Regional Food Bank Hudson Valley and Regional Food Bank, you know, general, is providing the food or helping to provide a good portion of that food to the folks and to our partners that we distribute. It's a large amount. And when people want to donate, because we can buy in such bulk, when somebody donates $1, that provides 4 meals. Mm. You know, and so we, again, $1 donation is 4 meals. So if you think about it, if someone's going to donate $20 or drop in a bucket or give a $20 donation, think how many meals we can feed to the children and people. So the money makes a great impact. Volunteers makes a great impact. And certainly we would encourage people to reach out to us for those hard hat tours that Felicia mentioned, because I think people will be really surprised and blown away, and they'll see how much impact we can have on folks.
Yeah. I mean, I had an eye-opening experience during the pandemic. I drove around with Marty Clavito for the Community Cupboard. I think he gets food also from the food bank. Yes. And I was just amazed, taken aback of how many people in Sullivan County had food insecurity. And some of them were working people. It wasn't, that's the thing, that was the thing amazing. It wasn't that people who weren't working. It was people who actually had jobs.
Yeah, that's the thing, I think. You know, it's one of these really grace, there before the grace of God feelings. I think there are perceptions of who's on, mm. who's getting, food stamps, or who's able to donate food. And I think what we found, especially during the pandemic, that, you know, hard-hitting families, husband, wife, both working. We know in Sullivan County, you know, you're trying to make ends meet, and you're bringing in what is a good salary, or you think so, and you've got insurance and everything. But you go to the supermarket and you got a family four, and you know the other prices of utilities and everything is going up. So the food bank is a way of helping people. You know, it's a lot of the folks, they have jobs. You know, they are working, but they're still struggling. And if we can help provide some nourishing food, you know, some extra vegetables and fruit to people, you know, that's a wonderful feeling. And as you said, you visit a food bank, you visit a pantry. I think people will be surprised of who is there And, you know, there were seniors who, you know, particularly in Sullivan County, such a rural area, how far it is. Somebody's got to take a cab ride. So they're spending $30, $40, maybe round trip to a supermarket to get food. Well, that's $30, $40 that they can't spend to get the food. And so something gives. It's either medicine, it's a utility, it's the food. And so what we can do is make life a little bit easier for those folks.
Absolutely. Felicia, Barry, anything else before we go that we haven't mentioned you want folks to know about?
I think, you know, whether you're a business owner, government official, just a community member, there is a way for you to get involved. We need all hands on deck to address this growing need. And, you know, that's why we're here. We want to bring all the partners together. And, you know, thank you so much again for having us. And as Barry said, reach out to us on our website and we'll find a way to get you connected.
Sure. Barry, do you want to give that website out again?
Sure. It's regionalfoodbank.net. You know, as sometimes we all do with, you know, we'll use the phrase Google, you know, you type in Regional Food Bank, Hudson Valley, Regional Food Bank, New York, you're going to come to the site. You know, you'll get the code. You'll be able to see it. Again, our new CEO, Tom Nadachi, is helping lead and this transformative move by the food bank. And I think people, by going on the site and talking with us, you know, you tell them you're with the food bank and they're very willing and they get the mission. They understand what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk to Felicia and Barry of the Regional Food Bank. Thank you so much for joining me in this morning in the program and really talking about a really important thing that really affects us all. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, the CDC confirms a COVID surge is underway in several states across the U.S., but does that include our area? We'll get the latest from the medical director at Ellenville after this break. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There's a rumba in the jungle this week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, plus a flute nightmare from Xavier Cugat, and Living Percussion plays Sonny and Cher. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo. A total of 42 states across the U.S. have a growing COVID transmission rates based on CDC data collected from May 22nd to July 16th this year, an indication of continued COVID-related illnesses. COVID-19 cases are still low in New York State, but steadily picking up this summer as new variants emerge. Tim Bruno spoke to Dr. Matthew Stoppel, medical director at Ellenville Regional Hospital, about the COVID surge this summer.
This is becoming a trend, right? I don't know that it's much of a surprise anymore. I remember the first year was like, huh? You know, usually viral infections, the flu and stuff, die down as summer comes on. But now, what is it? I think 4 years now we're going on. We get this this other peak in this, you know, early summer, late spring, early summer peak. And the other trend is it's somewhat regional, right? So in the Northeast, we get a peak in, you know, November, December into like January. And then this peak, although we certainly feel it in the Northeast, is felt, you know, much more strongly in, you know, the southern states, particularly I think like California, Florida, Texas, but we certainly feel it as well. And this has become kind of an established pattern now.
And this is still something that folks who are immunocompromised or elderly should pay attention to. This virus still poses a risk to those populations.
Yeah. Oh, no. People still get very sick from this. And you're right, people particularly elderly, infirmed, immunocompromised, can become very sick. They stopped publishing the numbers. There used to be that tracker in the New York Times where you could look at how many cases, how many hospitalizations, how many deaths. I don't know that they published that anywhere as near as widely, but the number I heard is I believe that in 2024 there's still 26,000 Americans have died from COVID. So it still can be serious.
It's August. We're looking toward fall now. Will we start getting some guidance from CDC about the vaccines that are coming out?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that they anticipate having a vaccine coming out in the fall, kind of combined with flu season vaccine, like last year. And my understanding is that that's going to be the recommendation again this fall.
And any other guidance you want to just remind folks of about how to stay safe?
So, I mean, actually, so the CDC guidelines on this, at sometimes during this epidemic or this COVID evolution over years, sometimes I've agreed with them more or less. And I think that some people cause some frustration or misunderstanding, and they seem to some to be very lax. But I like the general gist of it in that the idea is if you are sick, so if you are having fevers, chills, cough, that you actually, it doesn't so much matter what you have, you shouldn't be out and about in public. And if you are, you should wear a mask. Certainly if you have COVID, you shouldn't be out and about, but if you have anything that's causing fevers, chills, cough, causing you to be ill. And I would have to say, this time of year, what is going on? If you have, a bit of a scratchy throat, feeling a bit hoarse, you very well may have COVID. And I think you should be aware that, this is a contagious disease. You may spread it to your fellow community members, and you should, wear a mask if you must go out. Not go out or go to work if you're sick and you could avoid it. I think you got to be conscientious of this, a conscientious member of your community.
Yeah, a runny nose, fever, or cough could be a symptom of this viral infection. Kids might be going back to school in some parts of our region in the next few weeks. Any concerns with that, or do you think we'll continue to see a spike, or does it level off when the kids are back in school?
I mean, these things always, when kids go back to school, particularly younger kids who haven't been around other kids a lot, you get a spike in viral illnesses of all sorts. And I'm sure when kids go back to school, that will happen. If you look at past year's trends for what happens for this summer variant, it does seem to actually ends up tapering off a bit and then start to spike up later on. I said kind of back around Thanksgiving when everybody starts to travel around for holidays and be stuck indoors. So I don't think we need to be especially worried this year when school season rolls around.
Yeah, and again, though, if kids are feeling sick, stay home from school is the best guidance there, I think. And
100%.
And then the guidance from CDC is that when those vaccines, the new ones that are coming out, anyone 6 months of age or older should be vaccinated.
Yeah, and I think they stress time and again that the vaccine doesn't necessarily prevent you from getting the illness, but does minimize or mitigate the severity of that illness. And I think that's why the guidelines have been, relaxed a bit. By now, pretty much everybody has had some experience with this virus. They've either been vaccinated or had it, or both several times, which, although, yes, it still can be quite serious for some people, by and large, for most people who get it, it is not the terrible illness it once was.
Is it closer to being like the flu? Is it there yet?
So, yeah, kind of a very controversial statement.
I guess, like, yeah.
If you said that several years ago, people would think you were crazy. But yeah, you know, the coronavirus, you know, has been around in circulation for, you know, hundreds of years, causing, you know, cold and flu-like illness. And the reason why, you know, COVID-19 was so bad was that, you know, people hadn't been exposed to it. But now, as I said, almost everybody has been exposed to it. So it's no longer novel coronavirus. This is, you know, COVID-19 and all of its multiple variants have kind of entered the pantheon of coronaviruses that have been causing, you know, colds and flu-like symptoms for a long time. And, yeah, it still seems to be a bit more, dangerous for some people and have more kind of long-term consequences for some people than, you know, just your typical run-of-the-mill cold. But for many, many people, as you said, it has become, you know, kind of analogous to the flu.
And just to be clear, getting the flu, getting COVID-19, neither one of those good to get. Still see thousands of deaths from each of those, so important to be protected, as we've mentioned. Dr. Matthew Stupple, the medical director at Ellenville Regional Hospital in Ellenville, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We'll take a break. When we come back, local economics and author James B. Hunting will give us the perspective. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricio Robayo. This just in from Sullivan County Government. Out of abundance of caution, the Sullivan County Government Center in Monticello is now closed due to an emailed threat to the building. This is coming from their Facebook post. I quote, "We anticipate reopening tomorrow, Tuesday, August 6th. All other county offices are remaining open at this time, including the Career Center for the Courthouse in Monticello and Social Services Complex in Liberty." So let's move on to the economic news. Time for Work Shift Live. Local economics perspective from local economist and author James B. Huntington. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Patricio. Good morning, listeners.
Now, James, I have to be honest with you. We normally have your theme song here, which is 9 to 5, and for some reason, I cannot find it. So we just have to, if you want, we could sing it right now. But
working 9 to 5 for the way to make a living. Don't egg me on. I'll do that.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining us here on a Monday morning. The big news is I would like to find out what exactly is happening. What happened on Friday's job report?
Yes, well, it was poor. It was the worst in years, probably. Overall, we had 104 14,000 net new non-farm payroll positions against estimates. Three estimates I saw published for 175,000. That's still not so bad. It's still decent because population increased only 163,000 in this country, and that covered that. But it still was the worst increase in jobs in months. The second worst in 3 years, something like that. Unemployment was up from 4.1 to 4.3%. That's the seasonally adjusted variety. The unadjusted also went up 0.2% from 4.5%. So number of unemployed was up 400,000 to 7.2 million. Employment population ratio went down from 60.1 to 60% even. The number of people working part-time for economic reasons or keeping part-time positions while looking for full-time ones and not yet finding them, that went up a lot from went up 400,000 to 4.6 million. Average hourly non-farm private payroll earnings were about the same as inflation, up 8 cents to 35.07, and the long-term employed, those who are out for 27 weeks or longer, is still at 1.5 million. That's not very good because it was about 1.2 for several months approximately earlier this year. So people claiming no interest in work, that went down about 800,000. And the American job shortage number, or AJSN, which shows how many additional positions could be quickly filled if everyone knew they would be easy to get, it shows latent demand, and that went up just about 600,000. So we're now 17.9 million jobs short of what could potentially be easily absorbed. Labor force participation did a good job, though. It gained 0.1% to 62.7. So what that tells us, what all that tells us, is that we actually gained jobs and we gained the number of people working, but we added so many to the labor force. So many people rejoined them, and many of them did not find work, or many of people who were working lost jobs and didn't find new ones. So that's the thing. I mean, the labor force is growing faster than the number of jobs. Inflation is sitting at 2.5%. At least that's actually going down about 0.1% for several months in a row now. But totally reasonable, except the Federal Reserve has a target of 2%. So they have not been lowering interest rates yet. So I'll have more on that later, but generally this was a no-progress jobs report.
Right. So, you know, talking about the federal, what are the chances in for the September interest rate cut, and how much do you think it will be?
Well, they missed cutting interest rates because the Fed's meeting was 2 days before the jobs report. It's almost certain that they would have cut them had the jobs report been earlier enough so they could figure in the information. So they're getting some flack by people who said they should have cut interest rates, but that's really only in hindsight. At the time they had the meeting, it did not quite look, or it was marginal at best, that they should cut them at all now. So nothing on July 31st, but they'll meet again in September. And it seems exceedingly likely that they will cut interest rates. The press, about everyone in the press, has been saying that they would do it. The Fed chair has not commented. He did his commenting 2 days before the jobs report again. But there almost certainly will be some reduction. And I wrote before I saw any responses, any comments on the jobs report, that this would really call for more than the nominal quarter of a percent, that it should be a half and three quarters. And I was pleasantly surprised to see that everyone else was saying that too. So I think it will be three quarters of a percent. It might be only half a percent, and it might even be one full percent, but it's not at this point going to be only a quarter of a percent, because it is scaring people. It's disturbing people. And as I will tell you later on in this show, the stock market didn't like that at all.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to the stock market in a little while, but let's talk about that. Why wouldn't the stock market, what is the outlook for the stock market after this news?
Oh, what is happening? What was it like early this morning, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, I can run down the whole list of commodities here. We have gold. These are as of early this morning. Gold is at $24.24, which is up $31, getting treated really as a safe haven with a lot of things going on. Silver, $27.99, up 9 cents. You have a ratio of silver to gold, gold to silver of 86-1. It's silver still lagging. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, as of early this morning, it was 39,237, reflecting a loss of 1,312 over the past week. I'm looking now at a current or maybe 5 minutes behind listing of what the market measures are at, and it's now 38,628, which means it has dumped, really. It's dumped over 1,000 this morning. So that is very much a matter of concern there. Also, NASDAQ over the past week was 16,776 early this morning. That's down 710. That's doing worse proportionally than the Dow, because not only did it hate the employment report, but the artificial intelligence concerns with companies not making as much money and raising capital expenses ever higher. Not really well known what's going to happen. It's now at 16,158, meaning it's dumped about another 600 since then. That's a lot. These are some hefty percentages for one day of a terrible few days. On the good side, oil, West Texas Intermediate, 72.92, which means it dropped over $4. Things have a way of all going up or all going down at the same time, but at least we should get some kind of discount. It really should be coming down at the pumps. Expect lower this week, because it's now down $10 from where it was camping out for a long time. Bitcoin really went down the John. It's 52,514, which means it lost in the past week 16,448. The comment I saw on this was, investors are selling out of risky assets. A bad week, and the Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies are about as risky, as aggressive as you can get. Looking at it now, it's not done well. It's up about 1,000 today, 900 actually, since early this morning. It's 53,000 and some, so that hasn't got any worse anyway. British pound, 1.2794, down 39 hundredths of an ounce. Let's see, Britain still has real inflation and the problems of their own. The euro, though, went up 1.0957, up 1.4 cents. It's surprising. And the Japanese 100 yen, who surprised everybody by jumping a nickel to 70 cents. A lot of support from the Japanese government. It's gone up from 62 cents after being in the low to mid 60s, and now it's reaching some long-time highs. So overall, quite a week, not a good one. This could continue, but today looks like it's going to have to be an awfully good afternoon to get up to even on these things, looking at these prices now. So hang on. It will get better, but it may get worse before it gets better.
Right. Well, Jim, we're running out of time a little bit here, but I want to talk about you have a multi-employee job fair coming up. When is it and where is it?
Yes, this is in
Milford, actually. It's going to be at the Wallenpaupack Area High School. It runs on August 14th, which is a week from Wednesday. It's 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's totally free for everyone. There are going to be about 20 employers from Pike, Wayne, and Monroe counties. So there will be a lot of employment opportunities in education, healthcare, hospitality, law enforcement and corrections, sales, and more. So, yes, please contact this station if you have any more questions about it.
Right. And one more topic here I wanted to like talk about. You know, there's a lot of talks about the state's mandates for the state's climate goals for zero admissions. And now we're talking about, there's a big push for electric cars now with infrastructure building up slowly. Are electric cars right now a good value?
Well, this is a relatively new article. This has shifted around how good a value electric cars actually are. But they're saying the batteries last a long time. The range, I really don't know. It's a good asking about what range actually is to an electric car company is a good way of really scaring them and getting them to shut up or change the topic. So, I mean, in response to a question, is battery longevity a problem? They're saying the batteries themselves last for 8 years, which is about double what a normal gas-powered car's battery tends to go. So they are better about working in bad weather and such things. So that is not the problem. Now, resale value, you talk about value. Apparently, they're not so bad. They're not as bad as they were back when Hertz released 15,000 electric vehicles on the market. They got them out of their rental car fleet. At that point, it really dropped like a stone, the value of used ones. So now they're saying here they depreciated 49% over 5 years compared to 39% for vehicles overall. So one analyst said, why would you buy a car used when you can get the same car new? That would seem to mean that used ones are going down further. Fuel savings, the other things, yes. I mean, the prices they have here, which may or may not reflect real market things, are that they cost about $8,000 more than the average vehicle in general. So it's $56,000 and some. That includes a lot of things, but it may be, we may save, they're mentioning that one vehicle, a Ford F-150, which is available in gas and electric forms, they're saying that costs, that will save you about $1,100 a year if you're having an electric one in most areas. I don't know if that's going to be higher or lower in this area, but it seems like that's one area in which electric cars are cost-effective.
Well, Jim, we've run out of time, but thank you again so much for talking to us and letting us know what's happening in the economic world. We're talking to James B. Huntening. James, until next week, thank you so much.
Thank you, Patricio. Thank you, listeners.
Well, we'll be right back and talk to Forsberg Playhouse about what's happening at the Forsberg Playhouse. We'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we go west to Los Angeles, the home of the Dodgers. The story behind the complicated relationship between Dodgers Stadium and a Mexican-American community in the 1950s. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another way to help us bring you the news is donate a vehicle you don't need. Car, truck, motorcycle. You can donate to this station and it could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not. Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatsko. I'm Patricio Robayo. In the Works, In the Woods Festival at the Forestburg Playhouse is an annual theater festival celebrating the emerging artists and new theatrical works. The fourth annual In the Works, In the Woods Festival runs from September 6th to the 8th at the Playhouse. And here to tell us more of this year's lineup, our Director of Creative Development, Mac Lenz. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So, but make sure, say again your mic. Let me hear your mic again.
Pardon me? Yeah? Is that?
Yes.
How's that?
Perfect. There we go. Just to make sure I got the levels right here.
Great. Good.
Okay. So how does it feel to reach the fourth year of this festival?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, this really started out of a kind of a little pipe dream and maybe a glass of wine during the pandemic. And we started talking about, wouldn't it be wonderful for the Playhouse to be able to have the ability to develop new work. There's so much worthy writing going on in the theater, and not enough opportunity, you know, and especially coming out of the pandemic. So we created this festival from scratch, and here we are going into the fourth year, and it's just growing and expanding exponentially every year. It's so it's really cool. I mean, this year we had about 160 submissions.
Wow.
Of new plays and musicals, all of which myself and a small committee read. And from that, we chose four really amazing, worthy new plays and musicals. So,
wow, that's really tough. Over 160, and then whittled it down to 44 plays.
Yeah. So this year we're doing, we basically have five elements to the festival. Two new plays and two new musicals, and then we do a cabaret element. So we have two people who have never done a solo cabaret before come up and develop a show with us and their directors and musical directors. This year, those two people are Sidney DuPont, who was a Tony nominee a couple of years ago for a musical called Paradise Square, and Alyssa Payne, who is a TikTok kind of crazy sensation on TikTok, original songwriter. So she's putting together a show of a lot of original music. And Sydney's show is about sort of Sammy Davis Jr.'s influence on him and growing up. And so that's the cabaret element. The play this year, one of the plays, is called Palimpsest. It's by a playwright named Alex Sobler, who's been produced all over the country, and but this is a brand new play. This is the first time it'll ever be seen by an audience. We've got an amazing cast of Broadway and television stars coming up to do that with her. A new musical called Rebel Genius that is written by a guy named Matthew Puckett, who is a songwriter in Los Angeles, does a lot of rock and roll music, and Rebel Genius is a about the life and loves of a young Albert Einstein.
Oh,
actually,
okay.
And it's a pop rock score.
Wow, that sounds cool.
So it's like, you know, romance and, you know, quantum physics. So no, it's really great. And the songs are like, it's just chock full of like amazing songs. So also another musical we're doing is called Roja, which is a bilingual musical by a guy named Jaime Lozano, who's a Mexican-American composer. He's getting a lot of attention in New York right now, doing a lot of things. They were actually up here for a week in the spring developing Roja, which is kind of Aztec mythology mixed with Little Red Riding Hood and sort of a border story. And it's told in a bilingual dialogue and music. So That's another musical we're doing. And then we're doing a play called I Wanna Be Good. That's a solo piece written and performed by an actor named Michael Mastro, who is currently on Law & Order SVU and has been on a bunch of Broadway shows and all of that. So this is his first time ever writing a piece. And it's a coming of age story for him growing up actually in upstate New York.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just up on the other side of the river, not far.
Well, wow, so great selection. And I'm interested in that selection because you had so many submissions. And what is the process of whittling that all down?
Yeah, I mean, the main criteria and priorities for us is that it's never had a full production before, you know, because we really want to give a development opportunity. So, you know, we're able to sort of take a few off the top that if they've already had productions, you know, we're wanting to nurture stuff that's at an earlier stage of development. And then we read through all of it. Some gets eliminated because it's just not that great. And some of it, I try to think about what our audience would be, you know, keen to. So we whittle it down to about 20 in each category. And then I have a larger group of about 12 advisory committee folks read it. And they send me their top two choices. And then from that, I try to create a varied and balanced program and put it all together. And it really sort of comes down to themes and subject matter and all of that. We don't want to have a whole bunch of things that are all about the same, you know, topic or something. So I try to mix it up. So unfortunately, there are some really worthy, amazing projects that, you know, we just can't do. But, you know, I always say submit and maybe it'll carry over to next year, you know. But it's really exciting. I mean, we bring up about 60 writers, directors, actors, musical directors. They're all here for a week, the first week in September. And then, as you said, the actual festival and presentations take place on that weekend of September 6th through 8th. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday are chock full of staged readings. And also this year we have what we call off-the-cuff conversations with renowned theater makers. Mm-hmm. This year, Rick Ellis, who wrote Jersey Boys and Water for Elephants, that's currently on Broadway, and Peter and the Starcatcher, he's coming up, and we'll just do a kind of casual interview with him.
On stage?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
And we also have this year a guy named Bill Berlone, who is kind of the preeminent animal trainer for Broadway shows and does a lot of animal training for television and films. And so he's got a very unique perspective on the business as well, and just how that works and how he interfaces with creative teams and, you know, all of that. And Joan Marcus this year is also coming up, and she is the main theater photographer for the New York Times. So if you've ever seen a picture of a Broadway show in the New York Times, Joan took that. So we try to, in the off-the-cuff conversations, get a unique, you know, varied perspectives on the business. So,
right. It's amazing what Forsberg, I mean, has always been, but Forsberg's really such a, sort of became sort of a mecca up here for theater folks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, this area, as you very well know, has a really long history and legacy, particularly of theater writers, you know, rock and roll and visual arts and all of it as well. But there's some legendary theater composers and directors and choreographers that have lived up here and created up here. And so part of this, you know, I felt like it's in the air. It's in the DNA of the area. And, you know, we actually chose a tree as our logo because we wanted to kind of, you know, dig down into the roots of the entertainment legacy up here. Of course, the Borscht Belt, you know, all of it. So we're happy to help continue that energy of creativity up here.
Right. Now, so where can folks get more information for this upcoming festival?
Yeah, you can go to the website for Forsberg, which is fbplayhouse.org/ITW. And it has all of the information about In the Works in the Woods on there. We're also on Instagram at In the Works in the Woods. So you can look us up there, and that'll, you know, we have, you know, daily stories about what's happening and the artists that are involved, or call the box office at the Playhouse.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. That's a great festival coming up, and it's really great that all these artists have come together and it's great to just work there. Happens and it's a festival. Are all the plays being done each day, or just sort of spread out throughout the weekend?
Yeah. So in the next couple of days, we'll actually get the full schedule on the website. But each piece does two staged readings, so you'll have two opportunities to see each piece. The off-the-cuff conversations only happen once, but you'll see it lays out. There's stuff going on all day. I try to lay it out as much as possible so that everybody can see everything that they want to see. And people, the way you get access is through buying a passport. And the varying levels of passports have the varying levels of access over the weekend. the top right. level, you can get into everything. And then there's a day pass where you can just come for one day and see, you know, a bunch of shows. But it's a chock full weekend. And we also have, you know, local vendors, Do Good Spirits, Grizzly Bagels. You know, we have people coming on campus during the weekend as well. So,
well, Michael, thank you so much for joining me here on the program. We're talking to Michael Lenz, Director of Creative Development for Forsberg. In-